Welcome to another episode of Undisciplined. Undisciplined is a collaboration between the African and African American Studies program at the University of Arkansas and KUAF.
We'll be bringing you some of the best of what's happening in academia, taking it outside of the ivory towers, connecting it to what's buzzing in popular culture, and give you our take.
Taking the undisciplined approach of Africana studies outside of the classroom, into the community, and onto the airwaves, we invite you to share in research, ideas, movements of scholars and students, and members of Africa and the diaspora. I am your host, Dr. Karee Banton.
And I'm your co-host, Dr. Carrie Nisia Connor.
Let's get undisciplined! Good morning to our guests and listeners. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Undisciplined. We're in for a treat today.
Indeed.
That's right. Today we're going to be talking to one of my favorite people, right? You know, you don't have to be family by blood, right? Especially in the Black community. Yeah. And because he's an anthropologist, we could even talk about that too.
Chosen family.
Right? One of my chosen family members. I'm so happy to introduce him to you. His name is Craig Stevens. He is completing his doctoral research in anthropology at Northwestern University, and he is using anthropological and archaeological data through creative processes and immersive processes to think about a whole bunch of things that he's going to talk to us today, right? He's been using archaeological research to think about placemaking, ideas and strategies in the 19th century for Black Americans, for Caribbean people who went back to Africa, especially to Liberia. And one of the fascinating things that he's been doing that has really been thrilling everybody is using 3D digitization and this kind of very innovative curatorial strategies to expose these kinds of different diverse audiences to African and African diasporic material culture. One of the things that you can check him out on is that he recently developed and curated this collection called Augmented Curiosities for the Herskovitz Library of African Studies at Northwestern. And he uses augmented and virtual reality technologies to provide these opportunities to engage with African objects and artifacts. So, you know who Craig reminds me of? You remember that scene in Black Panther where Killmonger goes to the museum? Yeah, here's your Killmonger. Craig, what's up? Did you see Killmonger?
I know where this really came from. I know where this mask is really from. The curator shook.
Did you see Killmonger and you were like, I know what I could do in my research?
I'm not going to lie to you. It was an inspirational scene. It really did have an effect on me.
What was the effect? Tell us.
I mean, to use the tools and the resources, the strategies that you have to do something kind of radically imaginative. If the space that you're in, the industries that you're operating in, if it's museums and objects, if it's journalism, if it's film and television, I think there's a lot of ways that we can use the methods of our industries to create, you know, really inspiring futures, equitable futures. So Killmonger doing it his way, I definitely can relate to how you can be in a space and turn it to something beautiful or radically, you know, or activism. You can bring activism into wherever you're occupying.
So start with telling us, how did you get to this research? How did you get to be in anthropology and archaeology? Why not history, Craig? Why are you like that?
I'm really inspired by objects. I love material-based storytelling. That's what brought me to archaeology. I started in anthropology by being really interested in identity formation. I wanted to understand what Blackness meant, how it operated, how it worked in place, how it moved. But I was at a university that had a classics program. So classics folks, they study Greece, Rome, and they had archaeologists there. One aspect of getting into archaeology is doing these things called field schools. I think it's probably one of the most inequitable parts of our industry still. You're spending hundreds, if not thousands of dollars to go pay to go be somebody's field hand, to go dig a pickaxe, shovel. But it gets you to be able to put onto your resume, onto your CV that you've done archaeology before. So he was interested in that. I just wanted to join him and go on a trip to Europe. This excavation was in Italy. So we did the whole Europe traveling thing. And then once we actually got to the excavation, it was a Roman port city. So an ancient Roman port city that was for elites. And this is one of these really beautiful archaeological sites, very romantic, sexy. It has, you're using magnetometry to see the traces of a Colosseum. We're pulling out these amphora, these humongous vases. We're finding dyeing factories. And when we've worked in Liberia, it's not always as beautiful as that. A lot of times you're just digging through sherds, finding little pieces of ceramics, digging through dirt. But this is a place that was really easy to be imaginative. But the unit that I worked in, we found a mosaic. So this was the floor of some rich guy's house. And what we were able to do is we were able to source the stones and look at the arrangement of that mosaic and know that it came from North Africa. So these were African artisans who 2000 years ago are creating the atmosphere for the elites of this Roman town. And it was nothing, I would have never thought about how African creative production was not only being marketed and traded around the world, but it was also being sought after. Like the Romans were investing in being able to create workshops in that part of the world. So thinking about how Africans have contributed to global history, I found that tying some of those underexplored, undercommunicated stories about African creativity, archaeology gave me an opportunity to do that in ways that I didn't see possible through the archive or even just through ethnographic research. I really wanted to try to get to evidence, and materials and objects are a way that I like to go about that.
Wow. He ain't no puppy. He a big dog. I see you. Okay.
Wow.
That's awesome. Sorry if that's offensive. I'm a TikToker,
I took it as a compliment.
so be a compliment.
You keep using this word imaginative. You said radically imaginative. And like, so what is the role of imagination in anthropology? And like, what connection are you making between imagination and your work?
I think the imagination part is the thing that makes me a bit atypical in anthropology. I think we're a social science that does attempt to be very rigorous, data-based. We try to be very scientific in even the way that we talk about things that feel like they escape science, like spirituality, identity. We try to be have rigorous, semi-structured interviews and code all of our different utterances. But for me, I think it's probably a way that I've moved through the isolation of being within this industry. I try to create products and processes that if I wasn't the person producing them, I would have been excited about the outcome. So, wanting to take this data that I'm collecting and making something that's more like a documentary, more like a video game, more like a comic book, more like a nonfiction novel. And so I think I try to imagine myself as the person who's receiving the products of all of my work, and then trying to create something that would ex excite me on the other end, or that I would feel proud of, or spend time, consuming that information. So when I think of imaginative, I try to think about things that don't exist, but that I have the ability and the resources to contribute to, and then trying to be ambitious in bringing those to life.
That's beautiful. That's powerful. I love that.
So, Craig, can you tell us about your dissertation and what you're trying to do with that? What story are you trying to tell? And just as Carnesia asked just now, how are you integrating history, anthropology, archaeology, and that imagination, that digital humanities aspect that is kind of harnessing your creative side.
So much of it had to do with you, Dr. Benson, and your book. I wouldn't be working in Liberia if it wasn't for the work that you did with your dissertation and then your first book. It inspired our whole project, More Auspicious Source. So, I'm part of the Back to Africa Heritage and Archaeology Research Project, and we investigate the placemaking processes, the archaeological and the political history of Back to Africa migrants who left in the 19th century, the Americas and the Caribbean, and went and settled in Liberia. And so, archaeologically, I try to understand what it meant for people of the diaspora to reintegrate back into Africa to build an African lifeway and the first African republic. And so, we've been working there since 2018. We work really closely with the National Museum of Liberia. During that time, I was also building up my just digital media skill sets. I first started that I thought I wanted to kind of make a documentary telling about the history of Liberia because I really saw myself in those people. I think 200 years ago, I was given the opportunity to either stay in America and deal with the enduring racial persecution, Reconstruction, Jim Crow. I probably would have said, let me take my chances and move back to Africa. So I very much so see myself in those people. And I wanted to try to create some kind of content that would allow for the present day generation to also be able to understand what they went through 200 years ago and to try to be a bit more strategic, because there were some outcomes that I guess we can talk about too, that this kind of dream of creating this Pan-African Republic, it didn't pan out the way that folks thought it would. So I was trying to tell that story, and what I realized is that the National Museum of Liberia could benefit from being able to be in relation with the material culture that was outside of Liberia. So I try to create a method where I can use technologies like photogrammetry, 3D digitization, augmented reality, and virtual reality to tell stories about objects, but also to help the National Museum of Liberia be kind of the authoritative voice of their material culture that's outside of Liberia. So for my dissertation, what I'm doing is I'm going to different US museums and making 3D models of objects, Liberian objects that are in their collection. And then I put those into a virtual reality experience. And in virtual reality, you're wearing these headsets, you're completely immersed in a virtual environment. And I give folks an opportunity to pick up an object with their virtual hands and interact with it. They can stretch it, minimize it, turn it over, look at the underside, really have this kind of intimate engagement. And then as well, they can enunciate their interpretations, their testimonies, the way that the object is making them feel. Or if they have some kind of expertise, they can speak about the context of how this object sits in its emotional, spiritual, or cultural position. And so what I'm doing is I'm taking those objects, putting them in virtual reality, and go into the villages or the regions in Liberia where they come from, and allowing those Liberians to access them, to intimately experience in them, but to also give their testimony about what they mean, and then providing that content back to the museum. So trying to use some of these technologies to allow for the communities, the source communities where objects come from, to have more agency in how they're interpreted and presented, but at the same time trying to move to the next stage of digitization, where we're not just taking two-dimensional photos of objects and saying that that's creating access, but really trying to use emerging technologies and push the humanities as far as we can to be able to create products that are interesting to the publics that we want to talk to and that we want to collaborate with.
That is, I'm nerding out over here because, like, you're connecting like the digitization of these artifacts with oral history. I'm an oral historian, so the fact that you're creating opportunities for the Liberian community to speak back, to tell the stories, to create the narrative around these artifacts is interesting. I think, I wonder though, is it still problematic that these artifacts are not in Liberia, but that they're found throughout the United States? Or do folks find that, like, no, we're just widespread, our influence is global?
Personally, I love museums. I think museums are one of the last institutions that we have in our society that we still trust. Folks are getting increasingly distrustful of the government. Most folks don't even trust the media. We go to podcasts and non-traditional platforms a lot. universities are under incredible critique. There's so many traditional institutions in our society that we don't trust anymore. I think museums are one of the few places where people come and are willing to learn. They're a bit open. So I think they play an incredibly important role in our society for the African diaspora. For myself, as an African diasporic man, being able to have close encounters with beautiful African material culture that I could project my identity on was incredibly formative. I don't think when I'm learning in school before, when I was learning in school about Africa, I wasn't, the word beauty wasn't
Ooh.
active, you know, or innovation wasn't active. But then when I can see lost wax brass casting, that was the only place in the world where that was happening, you know, crucibles and bead glass bead production from thousands of years ago before it spread to other parts of the world. The what materials could do for inspiring me, inspiring my African identity and me being proud of that and being able to project it onto something beautiful. I thought that was a really useful role for museums. And I want to have a career that is able to produce that for everybody. So to be able to be a Black American who has intimate appreciation and understanding of African material production, and then to be able to curate those things in a way that produces the surface area of identity projection for the African diasporic community that lives in the area of that museum, I think that's incredibly important. So I'm not one of the ones who thinks that every object that's in a museum should go back. I also just know, like, as I've been doing this work, conversations around repatriation and restitution, they're a
Definitely
lot more
reports to Al
nuanced.
Sharpton.
Yeah, Al Sharpton should talk.
What
We
did
should
you
have a
say, Curry?
conversation.
Say what? What did you say? I said that they're finna report you, the blacks finna report him to Al Sharpton. Because he's I've
not,
never
he
been to
started
Jamaica.
out on Killmonger and now he's like, oh, maybe not all the objects should go back. Tell us why, Craig. Well, I think there are objects that should go back, especially objects that were collected illicitly, contentiously. When you think about the Benin bronzes and things that were through these methods of violence, things like the Rosetta Stone, they're taken from conquest. You know, the Greek friezes. When folks are asking for objects to come back, they should go back. I've also heard on the other side, there's African countries, Cameroon, for example, who want more objects in America. So Cameroon has a nice relationship. The Bumoon Kingdom has a nice relationship with the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago. And they understand that there is a large Cameroonian diasporic population, second, third generation folks who may not ever come to Cameroon, but they want there to be an opportunity for them to relate to their art, to their heritage. And so the Bumoon King was in Chicago, I think, last month, and saying, "You guys have outdated things. We want to send you more stuff." This is a beautiful display of like a shrine within there. And so I also know that even for things like the Benin bronzes, not every object they're asking for them to come back, but they're saying, "We want you to be loaning these from us, from the Benin Oba. We want you to be able to associate these objects with our ownership, and you are borrowing them from us as a promotion, almost as marketing for our history and our heritage." So I do think this conversation around should an object go back or should it stay, there's a lot more room in the middle for us to figure out how objects, when they are out of their root, out of their context, they can still be made useful for communities.
Yeah,
you know we have the Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art here in Northwest Arkansas, and they have a similar arrangement with Fisk University with some of the art that they had, where it's on a it's it spends like I think half time at different places, and Fisk was able to raise a lot of funds when you know their doors almost shuttered and they were able to survive that way. So I'm pulling your legs, but I'm not going to report you to Al Sharpton,
That's okay. It'd
but
be an honor to talk it out with Al Sharpton, with the
yeah.
Rev.
No, I think that's a very a way I haven't thought about it before, you know, like the globalization of culture and the interconnectedness that is created, or potential of interconnectedness that can be created when you're recognizing and giving authority to these home places of these artifacts and ideas and stories and cultures. But you said that you were able to kind of like go into museums and just identify Liberian artifacts. So how do you how what are some things to look for when you're like, oh, this is a Liberian artifact, or is it just like named and you're able to kind of identify it that way?
One amazing thing that has happened within the last decade within museums is most museums have public object databases, public collections databases now that anybody in the world can search, and most of them have pretty good classification by at least by country you can find. Liberia is difficult because within the years that African material research, archaeology, anthropology was quite prolific, Liberia was very inaccessible. It was just going through civil wars, and then it had Ebola, and it was just Liberia's had a really hard time since the 80s. And so a lot of the research that has created really well provenance collections from Ghana, from Nigeria, Liberia hasn't had the same fate. So sometimes when I'm trying to find Liberian objects, I need to search by ethnic group. And sometimes I can search by national origin, but it's a bit hard. And so part of that is trying, part of my research is trying to document, do a survey of where Liberian objects are, and then make it available for those experts in Liberia, curators at the National Museum of Liberia, historians at the University of Liberia, as well as Cuttington University, trying to create an opportunity where those folks can better curate the objects that are outside of Liberia. But in relation, in comparison to other West African countries, Liberian objects are often not as available, not put on exhibition as much, and almost always they're not as well researched as others. So I'm trying to contribute to remedying that situation through the work that I'm doing through my dissertation.
But this is why your work is so amazing, Craig, right? Because this kind of innovative 3D curatorial practice that you're doing, as you just mentioned, whether it's the Biblical Kingdom, having their third generation folks in the US having access to an artifact that they're able to put in its proper spiritual or cultural, political context. What we've also discovered with a lot of museums is that they have a lot of stuff in the attic, in the collections that they never get to display. So imagine Craig's 3D virtual reality digitized process where people can walk up and they actually get to engage. A lot of these process, y'all Americans, y'all be going some places and be peeing on stuff. Yeah, Greece had
Have
to
no
shut down an
idea.
island. Greece had to shut down the island because people were going over there and doing the most. But imagine those delicate objects that we don't get to touch in museums. We don't get to see, right? Because you need space to display all of those things. But to
You need a
have it
story.
digitally, say what?
You need a story, like you need to be able to create an idea.
Yeah, so you don't have enough room or whatnot, you wouldn't be able to. But if you go in and maybe you can create different stories around different objects from either an ethnic group or a country or across different ethnic groups. Imagine thinking about the Niger Delta, right, before
Absolutely.
colonization or something like that. You could get to do that through a digital medium and tell a particular kind of story.
Absolutely. The vast majority of objects at museums are not on display. I mean, for there's good reason for that in terms of conservation, and these things are very fragile, but being able to have options to create really dynamic experience with the material culture without them having to always be available or able to be handled. I think digitization offers an amazing opportunity, not only just by being on your computer and being able to like spin an object around, but things like augmented reality. It's very easy now that if you are on a website, you could click a button, and then it's kind of like the for folks who maybe haven't had a lot of experiences with the technology. It's the same thing that allows for you to put like a Snapchat filter over your face. It's overlaying digital media onto a physical environment, or there was that really viral Pokemon Go application. So you could do something similar where you're on a collections website and then you tap a button and then it opens up what's already in your iPhone, which is an augmented reality application. And then you could have that object sitting in your living room, sitting on your desk, and you could feel like it's in the room with you when no objects were harmed in that process. Nothing was offended. You could really, if museums were intentional about this, and as I think they will be in the future, there's ways that you could create a lot of value for folks by accessibility. I think implicitly that's been the communication that museums have created, that the more valuable something is, the farther it needs to be away from the visitor. Think about the Mona Lisa and people needing to be 30 feet back with a rope around it. It's conveying to you that this object is very important and so important that we need to protect it from you. But I think there's a way that we can use these kind of curatorial styles that I'm trying to innovate, that value can actually be given to the users by their ability to access the object intimately, as opposed to feeling like they need distance because of how important it is.
Tell us about this, what you've learned working in Africa this last time. Tell us about that nice project that you did
In Nigeria or in Liberia?
in Nigeria.
That tell you a story?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, but I want to hear about it. Talk
I want to
about
tell you,
working with a very powerful historian, archaeologist, anthropologist.
So I have the privilege of working with Dr. Akin Ogunduran, who is in a very prolifically published archaeologist, a Nigerian man who's done a lot of work to make African and African diaspora archaeology be able to speak to each other. So he's recently come to Northwestern University. I've been, citing his work since I was in undergrad, and I never had the op I never thought that it would be a possibility that we would be working closely together. But he's doing really awesome work because he's in the history department. Now, most archaeologists are in anthropology departments. Anthropology is split into four fields in the US. There's linguistics, there's biological anthropology, there's cultural or ethnographic, and then there's archaeology. But he's sitting within a history department, so he's training folks that are typically I mean, archival or literary based researchers how to understand the African past through its objects. And so I joined him in Nigeria in this summer in July to do landscape photogrammetry. So we haven't really talked about photogrammetry, but it's this process of taking hundreds, if not thousands, of pictures of some object or some kind of, usually it's an object, some kind of material, and then putting those through a software that can make a 3D model. So you can do that with a handheld camera or an iPhone for something that's small, but you can also use a drone. And so what I do is I take hundreds of pictures or thousands of pictures with a drone of a landscape and then create a map that is three-dimensional so that you can really see elevation and contours. You can zoom in, you can zoom out, you can scale it in the same way that you could when I digitize an object. And so I joined him on that trip, and I was just really inspired by what I experienced in Nigeria. Nigeria benefits from having this multi-generational industry of Nigerian archaeologists who are researching their own past. Working in Liberia, it's a little bit different for similar reasons that I told you about how things were difficult since the 80s when a lot of these methods and techniques were gaining popularity. Nigeria was building an indigenous industry of archaeologists. And in Liberia, some of the first trained archaeologists are folks who are working with us since 2017. So to go to Nigeria and just see them developing their own research questions that have been multi-generational, like their advisors are working on similar projects, and now they're diving into the macrobotany to look at food ways, to look at gender relations and the things that we're working inside, to get really specific questions that mean something for Nigerians. And so that was just really, really inspiring for like African diaspora archaeologists are in a similar case. Like we're doing a lot of work researching our past in the diaspora, but just in West Africa, it was a bit more unique. And I know South Africa also, I mean, Ghana, they have some great archaeology industries and lineages of academics working on that. But Nigeria is just really special. So I hope to continue. I will be continuing to work in Nigeria. One of the things that Professor Akin Ogunduran and I are doing are we're making a database that is my vision for what I hope museums can do in the future that really uses 3D digitization as the core content as opposed to just two-dimensional figures. So if you Google a Material History Lab 3D database, you can see our first prototype. And what that will go into eventually is we're going to be digitizing objects in national museums in Nigeria, Nigerian objects that are in other collections in the US, and then putting them all in this database, and then traveling to, in the same way that I'm doing in Liberia, traveling to those regions in Nigeria and having indigenous folks give their interpretation of what these objects mean. So as people at the same time are looking at this archaeological data, morphological data, the provenance, where did it come from? What does it mean scientifically? They're also going to be immersed with this really creative, culturally grounded interpretations of people saying how the object makes them feel. So doing go into the emotion, into the science, and putting that all into one platform together is something that the work in Nigeria has inspired me to make possible, and try to see if we can do something innovative, but still have it highlight traditional aspects of African material culture research, but just take it to the next frontier.
Okay. That's really impactful work. Like, it makes me think about, like, ma'am, I need to create a black museum in my own way. Ask these blackety black questions of African Americanisms. I really love that. But still, you have not gotten out of my request for a story. I need some cultural wisdom, proverb or story, something that you learned from an artifact.
You know, I'm young. I'm still learning myself. I'm trying to understand. I'm trying to get the
Depending on your youth.
story myself. A story about an object. I can tell you. So, part of the creation of these methods, I had to test it because I think that this dorky stuff is really cool. And really interesting, but I wanted to make sure to kind of ground truth it to make sure that it was useful for folks in Liberia as well. So in February, I joined my colleague Chrislyn. Chrislyn LaRoy is a doctoral candidate at UPenn, and she's also a part of our Baja Back to Africa Heritage and Archaeology Research Project. And what we did is that we took a demo that I made. So I digitized some Liberian objects that are at the Herskovitz Library of African Studies at Northwestern and the University of Pennsylvania, as well as the Gabel Museum of Archaeology at Boston University. And I wanted to see how school children reacted to them. I mean, so we first started and we asked folks when we went to William Tubman High School in Monrovia, and we asked them, had any of them ever been to the National Museum of Liberia? And not a single one raised their hand. Maybe they're just being shy, being cool. Maybe some of them actually had come and they just didn't want to admit it. But there was nobody who told us that they had ever been to the National Museum of Liberia. And this is 10 minutes down the road from the university that we were at. However, when they had an opportunity to engage Liberian material culture in a similar way that they would at the museum, but doing it in virtual reality or augmented reality, they had lines outside the door of people who were excited. I mean, they're telling jokes, they're laughing, being able to play with objects. So I think one thing that I'm learning is that there is still incredible potential in objects, museums reaching the youth, but we just have to find the platform. So I guess it's not a story about an object, but I mean to say that I think objects have potentially a new life as we move forward. And it's hard to think about how technologies can radically change life ways that we have right now. And I think the best example we can think of is things like Google or Zoom. I mean, the possibilities that are now created when we dematerialize the telephone, and now we can just talk to each other and see each other. All these new possibilities for us to make podcasts in different parts of the country. What Google did to Rand McNally and MapQuest. When's the last time that you actually had to unfold a map to get where you're going? Now you touch a button, and all of that is dematerialized. And people, industries are wiped out in that. There was ways in which there was a lot of, I don't want to call it trauma, but there was a lot of change that happened. But new possibilities were created. So I think these objects, this experience, and how folks are projecting their experiences back to me is showing me that there's really new possibilities for academic work, for curatorial work that we're not fully embracing right now because we're caught in our habits. But I think the world is going to change, and we're obviously going to change with it. I mean, I think there's something around digitization and dematerialization that can help us imagine what that might look like.
Especially in the classroom. Like I'm a social studies teacher educator. And so like how do we bring such a process to the classroom and allow our students to tinker and imagine and ask questions and to interrogate stories and who gets to tell stories. Like I think it would be a very and there's no money, there's no funding for field trips. Kids don't go on field trips anymore. It's really a shame. I'm disappointed. So to be able to bring
Is that
museums to the
true?
classroom, I feel like it is. I don't know a kid who's been on a museum since I've been, or not a museum, on a field trip in the last 2 or 3 years,
That's tragic.
personally.
Wow.
Yeah, I loved field trips. I was a field trip guy, so
Yeah, I
yeah.
was a field trip. What? Oh, I was always present for field trips, man.
Yeah, come on.
My permission slip is signed.
Night before.
It is something else. But as a historian, what I could say, working with Craig and the crew, or Back to Africa historical archaeology crew, it has taught me so much in terms of, I'm jointly appointed in African and African American studies, and we pride ourselves on being interdisciplinary. But let me tell you something. I tried to use different kind of methodologies in my work and try to, tap in and whatnot. But I really did that thing when I'm with y'all in Liberia, because anthropology and archaeology, folks, oh my goodness. As a historian, we go to the archive and we look at our documents and we process it in our individual minds by ourselves. Thank you. I'm going to go to my room now. All right. Bye. Take care. All right. I'm going to think deeply about what I just saw. Okay. But anthropology and archaeology is such a collaborative process. Collaborating with the community, collaborating with other scholars, collaborating with students. It was a lot of togetherness. Togetherness
It's
was a lot.
like emotional battery drained.
But I just realized that it wasn't something that I was accustomed to. Like, I love the thinking together, and wow, I'm learning about this object. So, this is not a cheer. This is a sign of wealth in the 16th century, right? Oh, and this is a sign of what artisans practice, or what social design looked like in that period of time, and all that kind of stuff. And I'm fascinated by thinking about that kind of stuff, but to actually feel it in your body, right? Like, when Craig and I, when we're in Liberia, we're in the same house. We're eating breakfast together. We're eating lunch together. Like, we're stopping at the market, getting our lunch. We're going to dig. We're going to dig together for the artifacts. We're washing them together. We're doing all this kind of together stuff that as historians we do not do. What did you
There's a
think?
lot of intimacy that is involved in the anthropological and archaeological research process, and I think it's always been that way. You're often kind of estranged. You're going to a place that's far away, and you really need to depend on people to help you execute what you're doing. You also are answering really sprawling, wide questions that maybe need like a geoscientist, and maybe need somebody who specifies on ceramics, and somebody who's more of an oral history person. So I think the field has always been very collaborative, but it has not always been equitable. A
Oh,
lot
yeah.
of those relationships were very much so exploited the entire time. And I think anthropologists are really reflective. We have to think a lot about what we bring to a situation, and it allows for us to kind of reinvent what anthropology is. Often, I think like as a discipline, there's a lot of folks who try to think a lot about the consequences of their presence. And the largest critique, I guess, within the last 20 years of archaeology, that it is a still inherently colonial discipline. Anthropology was kind of a handmaiden for colonialism in a lot of ways. It was allowing for
Could you
folks to go.
explain what that means, you know, in
Yeah.
terms of the discipline of art anthropology coming into the into being in the university, and how it's been this kind of a space where colonial knowledge is deployed, and how you as a black person who have been prescribed the other, right, navigate that space.
Yeah, it's a discipline that's built on methods that allowed for information to flow from the colonies back to the empire. So you have people who are ethnographers who are documenting governing structures within Asian and African communities, documenting how money and economies work. And that data is going back to folks who funded those expeditions, those research trips, which are oftentimes colonial or imperial governments, and you're facilitating the exploitation of those folks for their resources or for their bodies. I mean, this is a time where the transatlantic slave trade is happening in West Africa, and finding ways to how you can take people who are good at growing certain kinds of crops or doing certain kinds of labors, and how you can use them within the Americas. Maybe you want to grow rice, people who are malaria resistant. There's a lot of what built anthropology in the 1900s and the late 1800s was upon the rails of colonialism. Also, having logistics and access to places that are quite underdeveloped, a lot of that was built upon the backbone of extractive colonial industries. And so what anthropology has done in reaction to that really valid critique is turned to community-based participatory research, really convincing or trying to encourage researchers, anthropological researchers, to ask questions that come from or are relevant or useful to the communities that you're working in. And to be honest, I think we've had a slight overcompensation in the way that we've gone about that. I think I'm within the generation of grad students who were very much so indoctrinated in this. It wasn't kind of like maybe you should do things that are more interested in the community. It's almost like your research is not valid, is not worthwhile if you are not very much so intimately relating your research interests to the interests of the people that are in the community that you work from. And when I say intimacy, I mean, when you think about your intimate relationships, it's not all easy. Like, intimacy is beautiful and it's worthwhile and it's what we live for, but there's pain, there's loss, there's difficulty, there's vulnerability. And for that to be part of your work, your everyday, that to be necessary for you to get your PhD, it's not something that I think I was trained for. I didn't have counseling for how to, enter a space and make friends or feel like you're making friends, and then you pull out radically, and then you go back to your well-resourced university, go back to the US while you still got people on WhatsApp texting you like, "Can you help me eat today?" And as a grad student, I think that's not something that we were prepared for. I know I definitely was not trained on how to deal with intimate relationships while doing community-based participatory research. So hopefully we find some way to, because it's a really good ambition. We should be doing research that is useful for the community. We also need to figure out how we take care of ourselves when we're entering some of those spaces, and allow for it to be a sustainable practice. So anthropology definitely was based in extraction, and it still is an extractive discipline. And so the way that we're trying to kind of make that more equitable is turn into the community. And I'm hoping that some of the techniques that I'm using are able to execute on that, and bring the community intimately into the process. But I think we're still, as a discipline, trying to figure out how to deal with that constant exposure to human beings, like you were talking about, Curry, eating breakfast and everything with the same people all the time. So.
That is such that's such an it's such an impressive insight, Craig. It's so amazing. Like, you, not because you're my homie, but you have range. Okay? You have range. Like, you've, I don't know, maybe this is built into, like I said, you're thrown out there, you had to go do research in Africa and be in these communities, and we're collaborating with folks where, you know, we ha they perceive us as having all this money, right? And you're trying to sustain a relationship because you don't want to, oh, we're coming to take your objects, or we're coming to, you have this thing that we need for our dissertations and our books, and we're coming to take it and then leave you high and dry. And then we have to figure out how we are going to manage all of that emotionally, right? Without developing some kind of codependent relationship also that can be ruinous for us. And not, I'm telling you, as scholars, that we have to develop these relationships with our students that does not get into that codependent space either, right? And I don't know if any of us know how to do that, because I mean, lots of us weren't taught to how to teach pe proper pedagogical practices either, right? We're like, read the art of teaching and then go into the classroom, you know? So, but that's an added dimension that I think people in archaeology and anthropology are having to grapple with that can foster the kinds of emotional intelligence that helps you not in terms of your own growing up as an adult or whatnot, but can, you know, help you accomplish the things that you want to do professionally.
Absolutely. Yeah. It makes you a more full human being doing this type of work, or being just being a stranger in a place. You really learn how you really need to rely on people. And the temptation to go and do something that's quite extractive just to pull your data and then go back to your office is so clear. I get why that was the last 100 years of social science work, is because dealing with all these relationships is distracting. I mean, if you're single-minded of, I need to get this book out, I'm trying to get my tenure, I need to go, I need to work, it does pull you away. And I do see, as I talk to folks who are going through the tenure process, you're getting a bit more points for community engaged work and service and things like that. But I still don't think it's there all the way. But definitely trying to have good intentions and have good outcomes for the work that I'm doing has encouraged me to work on myself and to have emotional intelligence and to understand how my presence and the privilege that I occupy, how that translates on the ground, and then trying to just be intentional in ways that I can take care of myself and also take care of the people that I work with the resources that I do have access to.
Karen,
Bringing out
is
the
it the
name.
same for you in education?
I don't have that tension. No. I feel like the relationships that I am building are very much reciprocal, in the sharing of knowledge and the sharing of that intimacy with one another. Of course, both parties have to choose to be a part of that relationship. But to feel like I'm going into a space and taking something from it, and there's an expectation on the other party that I, you know, not expectation, but a desire or a need that I can't fulfill. I don't feel like I experienced that tension. So I'm glad Craig shared that with us, because, you know, like it to struggle or to I would struggle with this tension between wanting to be an activist and balancing the line of not being a colonizer. So like that's just, I'm like, you need some anthropological therapy, because that is real deep. I couldn't do it.
Do you feel like the products of your research are more clearly beneficial for the people that you're collaborating with, perhaps more than what I'm describing? Is it the process of working within education that you're creating resources for people that more clearly relate to things that benefit them, as opposed to just being an academic process?
Yes, because I choose the people in the communities that I want to work with intentionally, because we see the world the same, or we have a desire to see the world in a certain way. So in my collections of oral history, you know, thinking about education reform, it is typically within a community that we share the same cultural background, maybe not in all aspects of social identity, but in terms of maybe where we're wanting, how we're wanting the field of education to progress, we have that same goal in mind. And that may not always be the case, but a lot of times in oral history, it's very cathartic and fulfilling for folks to be able to share their story and feel like they're contributing to a texture of history that normally doesn't focus on their stories.
I love that. Yeah, I've been really inspired by oral history work. Dr. Banton and I have done some, and as well as a collaborator that I mentioned, Chris Lynn Aurora, does a lot of oral history work, and the care and intention, again, the intimacy that is involved with that process, the mutual respect, is something very inspiring. And we try to integrate oral history into our archaeological work as just one of our one an additional data endpoint, not just focusing on what the objects and what the dirt is telling you, but also hear what people are telling you about their lived experiences and what their grandparents and their great grandparents told them about a space or an object. So I really do appreciate oral history methods. And honestly, what I'm doing with the digitization and trying to find ways to put objects in people's hands despite the time or the distance from where they are physically, I think is pulled, and I'm gonna be more intentional about writing about that. It's definitely pulled from what I've seen historians do on the oral history side. So I can appreciate what you're talking about.
And upon greater reflection, folks do feel vulnerable afterward, after sharing their story and feeling like, what are the consequences of mine sharing the story? And I think maybe some of the my responsibility is to help quell fears, and to ensure them, make them feel, okay, well, do you want me to embargo this for 2 years or hold on to this until you can get some time and space away from it? So there is that responsibility of being ethical. And like, we are curating a oral archive, right? And so I think it actually, yeah, it can feel, I'm feeling like a little bit of a colonizer right now.
I don't
Well,
think you should.
not too much on that now. You're fine.
Yeah.
Correct.
Need therapy now.
We all do. Facts.
You've been in a lot of museums, and we've had a few come on board in recent times. The Smithsonian Museum of African American History. I don't know if you've been to the one down in Charleston yet that overlooks that port where the largest amounts of African Americans came into. Which museum has been your favorite museum that you've been to? What did you like about it?
So the National Museum of African American History and Culture is my favorite museum in the world.
Oh my goodness, because you used to work there. Come on, that's so much biased.
I actually didn't work there, so this is real. It's real. No, I was in DC when there was a lot of energy around it, right when it opened, and it was very formative. I went to American University for undergrad in DC, and it was very formative to me thinking as museums as a place that were welcoming to Black folk, that were useful to Black folk, and something that I could be proud of. I mean, everybody who came to visit me to DC, if I could take them to the museum, I did. And that was a space that really inspired my career. So I have a deep appreciation for that museum. If I get an opportunity to work for that museum in the future, I'll likely take it. I was recently at the Brooklyn Museum because they have some Liberian objects, and I absolutely loved the way that they recently opened a new America Gallery, and they're putting contemporary art with archaeological materials and thinking about American cultural production and how different cultural groups and time periods that never existed at the same time, but were still speaking to each other through the creation of art. I love opportunities like that. I love contemporary art as well, even though I'm all ancient art and I do a lot of historical things. I hope to have an opportunity to be able to put African diasporic and African contemporary artists in conversation with archaeological materials and things that were made thousands or hundreds of years before them, and have them speak to each other. So I love to see curation like that. Also, I've been to some of the museums that are under incredible critique, like the Louvre and like the British Museum and the Kebron Lee, who have objects that they maybe shouldn't have. And to be able to also understand that that museums can contribute to present day conversations, and there's still social justice issues that curation can speak to, and conversations and collaborations with African institutions. I like the way that I see folks like the British Museum doing some of those things. Also, there's a big difference between public museums and private museums, which I'm learning. Places like the Smithsonian, where anybody and everybody can and might show up into the gallery, versus something like the Met or the Brooklyn Museum, where you're kind of getting a different slice of the hierarchy, the social hierarchy, because people have to be willing to pay a ticket. And I like all the differences in that. So truthfully, I hope to be able to work in collaboration with a lot of museums. I see myself as the skills that I'm developing can have an entrepreneurial aspect to it. So I hope to be able to be a consultant for a lot of different museums and to figure out what works best for me. Maybe someday somebody will give me a little center or a little gallery or let me like kind of put my own perspective onto it. But I think in the short term, I appreciate the opportunity to engage a diversity of museums, diversity of collections, and communities that they're serving. But those are some of the ones that I have enjoyed in the past.
I can see it now. Craig put in a Cora next to a banjo next to Jay-Z.
I'm
Yeah,
dying.
exactly. I told you that idea. Did I tell you that before?
Oprah next to a
I'm dying.
gumbo.
We won't collab. You got some good ideas.
Right.
I'm gonna call you
Well,
when I get my chance.
y'all
I'll
next time
let
I go to Africa, y'all take me with you. You know, something,
No
yeah, I
problem.
got
We can
you.
make that happen. We definitely can make that happen.
And Craig is a big time traveler too. I'm very fascinated about, given that you were working on the food stuff in Nigeria, and I know you've traced all that food ways all around the places that you've been, right?
I love West African food. I really do. I love eating with my hands. I love fufu. I love soup and I love rice. I eat well in Africa. I eat very, very well.
I think you made me like soup because I was not a soup girly. But I'll eat soup in the summer. Doesn't
Come on.
matter. No, I'm a
I'm
soup in the
gumbo right
Jamaican
now.
sense, in the gumbo sense, but I was not a fufu soup girly.
Oh yeah. And have
But
you
yeah,
changed?
the mofongo, the fufu to the mavongo to the different kind of mashes.
It's beautiful, and especially like you mentioned gumbo and it's I love the work that Foodways folks have done for looking at how expressive culture like dance, music, and food is the ways that Africa has maintained most in the African diaspora. And so when you go to West Africa and you taste something that tastes like something that you've had in Jamaica or that your grandma used to cook in the US, I love those types of connections. I mean, so much of what inspires me to travel to Africa a lot is just trying to have non, I don't have a better word besides cringe. I think a lot of ways that as Black Americans, we're presented opportunities to relate to Africa is like wearing a dashiki and like going to Ghana Fest or like listening to Burna Boy or like playing Fela Kuti. Like I just wanted to have like real experiences, like actually meet folks, be on the ground and like see how I feel in these spaces. And so I love that food is one of the ways that I get to have that just like beautiful feel like I'm in the past and the present and the future at the same time. Like it's just that's one of the best things about the African diasporic experience. There's this one end, well, you're a little different, Karee. Like you come from a Black hegemony, so like you can oftentimes proudly claim I'm from Jamaica, but sometimes it's a little difficult as Black American. Like I am happy to be American, and like it has changed, and I've gotten over some of that angst like I used to have. But there was a way in which I would go anywhere there Black people were, and they would accept me. They would be like, "Oh, you're Bayesian now. Oh, you're Nigerian. You're Liberian now." When they know I'm not, but they're like, "You look like me, so you're from here, and you like our food, so you're from here." And I always really just liked that experience when I wasn't feeling too proud from, I wasn't feeling too patriotic. So I just love
I want to be plain. I like that. Can I ask you
that.
guys, the both of you, something, Carnesia and Craig? Have you guys did your have you done any kind of DNA 23andMe testing to find out, or have you wondered about that, like where in Africa you might be from, or suspected you may be from a particular place? I haven't.
I
Both of
haven't
my
because
parents
I'm
have
done
like,
it.
okay, what'd they find?
Go my dad found some Jamaican. My dad had a large Jamaican. It's crazy because every time I go somewhere because of my hair, they always like, "Are you from Jamaica?" I'm like, "No." Anyways. And my mom actually, her matrilineal. So there's a really great website. This isn't an ad, but it's africanancestry.org. And they they give you tribe level
Data.
data, as opposed to, because that's why I always thought 23andMe was kind of silly for what I was interested in, because you're going to tell me I'm Nigerian, or you're going to tell me I'm from Togo, but
Tell
my
me whether I'm Igbo or Hausa
right, exactly, because my people have been in America since the 1700s, and these are countries that were founded in the 1950s. So
or
how are you going to
Yoruba
say I'm Nigerian when my ancestors had 200 years already been in America before Nigeria was founded? So my mother found that actually our matrilineal descent is Mende, which are southern Sierra, I mean, are Sierra Leone in northern Liberia, a place I'd already been working in Liberia after she found that out. So I just thought that was crazy that I was drawn into the exact part of the world, exact part of West Africa where I ancestrally descend from. So I do think that it's the ancestry tests are pretty cool. And but I also think that we have a particular vulnerability of, like, as an African diaspora, especially Black Americans, like wanting to know where we're from. And I think some companies can really take advantage of
Yeah,
that.
they're
So
gonna put that behind a paywall and make you pay for it after they done colonize the
and they have, that is
data.
a business, that is already their business model.
Sell my data, clone me. I don't need another me walking around here. Okay, y'all,
Yeah,
the
come on.
world. That
Come on.
Carnesia, I mean, Justice Craig was saying, right? They have all this data that they extracted that they own, whether it's in museums, whether it's in a archive or whatever, and us as a people, as a diaspora people who don't have access to certain parts of our heritage to make us come alive in certain ways, that's the business model of companies.
Wicked.
You know, I don't know. I feel like I would still have doubt. I feel like I would still have doubt no matter what platform I use. And I feel like I would still have this gaping hole inside of my soul of wondering where is my truth and where does it lie? So.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of industries that I think are built on that too. Even the tourism of the slave quarters, you know, like
Oh yeah.
going to,
Going to Ghana.
Elmina and Cape Coast Castle. Like there's whole industries that are built upon this diasporic longing that we have. So
Oh yeah.
I think you're right to be skeptical.
The last time we were at Asinmansu, the person was telling a whole story about Jamaica is named after an Akan word meaning Jamaica. I was like, stop, sir, stop. You stop it right now.
Is it not true? And you don't believe it?
Asinmansu like 4 or 5 times, and every
Right.
time the story is changing. I don't know if the Jamaicans keep showing up and like tell us a story about ourselves, make us feel better. Well, that was
Right.
me. Well, Craig, we thank you for the amazing work that you're doing. I'm excited for your dissertation, for myself, for others, for I what does it have a title yet? I'm
It's
still
in
working on it.
workshop, so no, I'm still working on it.
Well, when it comes out, we want to share it on our platform because I think you're just giving so much access to the richness of culture and interconnected global diversity of the African diaspora. And I think you're super doing super, super, super amazing work. So congratulations to you for getting into it. Sounds like you're really passionate about it too. So love it for you, love it for us.
Yeah,
Thank you, guys.
I love every time I talk to Craig, I'm inspired. I'm just like, oh my gosh, this is so great. This is amazing. You're doing amazing stuff. I know you're gonna be great. I know, whatever you envision will be a reality. And I'm just going to go ahead and be like, I'm gonna have all the pictures, be like, don't try to front on me. Don't try to front now that you're a celebrity out here. We knew exactly. I'm like,
Cool one. Thank you guys so much for providing the space, the platform. It's awesome to be able to have these kinds of conversations. So thank you guys.
Well, thank you, Craig. Looking forward to your visit and talk to you next time.
See you soon.
All right. And discipliners, get in touch with us. What's some museum? What's your favorite museum? What's an artifact that lives in your head rent-free? Get in touch with Craig Stevens. Where can they reach you, Craig?
You can go to BajaLiberia.com. And you can see all of our work that we're doing in Liberia. And I got my email and everything on there if you want to talk.
Let's get it. Until next time, family.
All right.
Thank you for listening to another riveting episode of Undisciplined, This episode was hosted by Karee Banton and Carnesia Connor. It was produced by Leah Grant. Undiscipline is a collaboration between the African-American Studies Program at the University of Arkansas and KUAF. It is available every other Wednesday at KUAF, on Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Follow the African and African-American Studies Program and the Undisciplined Podcast on Instagram at UARK_AAST or visit KUAF.com to listen to all episodes.
If you like today's episode, please subscribe to our podcast on Spotify or wherever you listen to your podcasts and rate us.